Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, party nominees for governor, U.S. Senate, and the House of Representatives will be chosen in the Pennsylvania primary May 17th, but over a million independent voters can't participate. And preserving the Pine Barrens' dwindling white cedar forests under threat by climate change. But to begin, we're discussing a blistering new report from a Philadelphia City Council special committee, which says the city has removed children from their homes for alleged abuse or neglect at a rate far higher than counterparts like New York or Chicago, with no evidence that Philadelphia's children are safer than those in other big cities. The report goes on to say that tearing families apart at a high rate overloads the Department of Human Services, making it more difficult for caseworkers to identify the relatively small number of children in acute danger. Recommendations include abolishing mandatory reporting, removing neglect as a definition of child abuse, rethinking removal of children from their families when domestic abuse is present, and strengthening legal support for parents. Councilman David O is co-chair of the special committee, and he joins us in studio on the Regional Roundup. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on this very important topic.
Well, thank you. There is a lot to unpack here. Again, Philly has been removing children from their homes at a higher rate than other big cities, according to this report. Why? What have you been able to determine?
Well, the rate is shocking. Three times higher than New York City, four times higher than Chicago, with no indication that there's any difference. In other words, there's not more abuse or anything like that. What we do have, however, is we have a very large population of poor and very poor people. In other words, we're known as the largest poor city in America. And part of the problem that I find occurring is that there are too many ways to remove children for reasons that are not what people would expect. In other words, has nothing to do with abuse or harm to children. First, we have an anonymous reporting system, which is weaponized. In other words, I don't like someone, so I start calling DHS and telling them that so-and-so is abusing their children. I don't give an explanation why. I just call 30 times, 40 times, and a record is kept. Now, there's no explanation that I'm giving in terms of the most important legal standard, reasonable suspicion. It's not written anywhere, and so when someone decides to visit that person's home, typically after the courts are closed, and there's a whole reason for that that we get into, because now it's an emergency. And so when they go there, they simply say, we are here investigating an allegation of child abuse. But they don't say what it is, why, where. They may not, for example, have to say who said it, but clearly they should say what they're looking for. And after investigating, they may determine in their records that the allegations are unfounded, yet they remove the children from the home. And let's say—
But the children are still removed from the home?
Yes, yes. And that is very disturbing, right? It disturbs me. It disturbs you. But yeah, when they remove the child, they remove the sibling. So they may remove four children, and having said that the allegations are unfounded, but what they've seen in the house is questionable, or let's say it's not questionable, then we get into the whole idea of mandated reporting. In other words, we have professional people like DHS workers, COA workers, teachers, principals, doctors, nurses. But under the mandated reporter laws, which sound very good, they are now subject to the 2020 hindsight of somebody who is not even of their caliber or position, who can now second guess them and say, 12 months ago, you should have reported this. And now they may be removed from performing their duties. They may not be able to teach. They may not be able to be a principal. They may not be able to be a nurse at a children's hospital. And therefore, we have over-reporting of everything and anything somebody might second guess.
They're afraid perhaps that their position might be threatened.
Yes.
Because they're not following the law. They might have made a mistake, so they just err on the side of caution.
Yes.
That's what you're saying.
And maybe they didn't make a mistake, but somebody says they made a mistake. So that is the problem with this system, that there's huge over-reporting, and it comes from the very top. What they have said to me when I raise the issue of the law requires that you have evidence of reasonable suspicion, their statement is more is better than less. And therefore, as someone said, you're trying to find a needle in a haystack, but you make the haystack bigger and bigger and bigger. It makes it harder to find and help those children who really need help.
Okay, so a couple of points, and we will get to the DHS response in just a moment. There are tragedies, Councilman O, which are simply horrific and which make headlines. But the committee has found that they are relatively rare. Is that accurate?
It's relatively rare that you have those horrific headlines. However, there is a lot of removal of children unnecessarily, and that each one of those is a tragedy. Each one of those is traumatic to the children. It's detrimental to them. It's harmful to the family. And in many cases, those children are not returned. They are not returned for years, and sometimes they're put up for adoption. And we can even go into situations where, for example, when we say domestic abuse, what we're talking about is a woman is battered by a boyfriend, and DHS comes in and says, you picked the wrong boyfriend. You exposed your child to violence, so we're removing your children. And then years later, though she has not had her children returned to her, she's pregnant, she's about to give birth, and they show up to take the unborn child. You know, when
even
it
if
is
the
born.
Boyfriend's not on the scene.
No longer on the scene.
So is this according to testimony that you have heard?
And listen, we vetted it. We cannot simply take what someone says. We have to check on what they say. We have to find evidence and proof. There are many cases where there's no evidence because, unlike, again, the police, who have a report, a incident report, a detective report, you know, they must keep a record of things. There are no records here. And therefore, we look for evidence that we can find. And in those cases, we have seen evidence that corroborate these narratives.
So let's stay with this issue of domestic abuse for just a moment. One of the recommendations, if I have this correct, is that child abuse investigations should not be launched necessarily over allegations of domestic abuse. So if a mother is being threatened at that moment or beaten by a partner in the home and a child witnesses this, the thought is removing the child might further harm the mother and the child? Because what I saw in the report was that you don't necessarily remove a child from all of these situations.
Yes. Wouldn't you remove the abuser from the household rather than abuse the child? I mean, remove the child from the mother. In many cases, the mother is just a victim. But now, does she want to report child abuse? Is she not subject to threats by the abusive person that if she reports something, DHS must be, mandated reporter, must be notified and DHS may come out? And one of the defaults that has occurred is, well, we don't want to do the wrong thing, so we're going to remove your children and leave it up to the judge. But that process then opens another can of worms and another problem, which is closed courtrooms and the fact that you are not in the courtroom. So by the time you get to your first court hearing and you don't have a lawyer and everybody's inside closed doors, they come out and tell you case is continued, which is very typical, and now you'll come back in 3 months. And then you come back and another 3 months, it's continued again.
So you are recommending that the court system procedure also be...
Yes.
Overhaul.
And one of the things, like open up the court systems, as in other jurisdictions that have had tremendously good results, no one complaining. And as you said, as you referred, do not make victims of domestic abuse victims again by removing their children. They have done nothing wrong. Their children have done nothing wrong. But now you are moving the child from their mother rather than simply removing the abuser from the household.
I'd like to get to another recommendation that neglect wouldn't necessarily classify as child abuse warranting a child's removal from the family. We did speak off mic with an advocate who's pushing back hard against this, Frank Cervone, head of child advocates, who says neglect shouldn't be removed from the definition and says, well, you know, for instance, how do we distinguish between poor families who can't afford cereal versus the family who has the capacity to give food but withholds it from the child?
So withholding food from a child is not neglect. That's abuse. And that is the problem with this entire conversation we're having. This is based on the best interests of the child and abuse. There can be abusive neglect. However, When someone, for example, is poor, which is many of our people, and they come into a stint where they're not able to get the type of food that they need for their children, wouldn't it be better, and wouldn't you and I expect, that they could call DHS and get some food delivered to their home? We have many nonprofit organizations, Phil Abundance, all kinds of friends helping families. We have all kinds of organizations that would help. So if they don't know any better, they could call DHS and they would refer them to a local church, mosque, temple. But instead, when they say, like, I don't have food, if they volunteer that information, that is a definition of neglect. And then they lose their children. That is a far more traumatic, damaging, and expensive, because the problem is we have children who need help. They need to be saved from abuse, and they should be removed. But those children are oftentimes not attended to because you have overwhelmed the system with things that are simply poverty.
You are calling, it sounds as if you're calling for an overhaul of the entire DHS procedural system when it comes to alleged child abuse cases.
A lot of it. And let me say that what I am advocating for is not actually new. We can see many examples across the United States of systems that have done these exact same recommendations and have proven history of success. New York City being a great example, and others as well.
Okay, we did get a response from DHS, which was not included in the review process, and received a copy of the report this past Saturday, April 29th. DHS sent us a note saying, we cannot help but share our disappointment that DHS was not included in the review process, and that an advanced copy of the report was not shared despite a direct request from the commissioner. Such a review would have given DHS an opportunity to work in partnership regarding concerns and recommendations. What was your thinking here?
So first of all, when I started this process, I did go to DHS and asked that we work together for what I thought was an issue of just misinformed mandated reporters. What they told me was, number one, they are properly informed, and I told them that's absolutely not true. You are saying that people can use gut feelings, tingly knot in their stomach. In other words, they're saying, if I look at you and I feel something funny about you, I should report you. Hmm. That's clearly wrong, and it leads to other problems. The other thing is that not only did they not admit that there's any need to move forward, when I said I would have a public hearing, what they said to me is it would be a political mistake, a huge political mistake. And I took that for what it was, a threat. And then when we have tried to work with them, they have been very, very insistent and aggressive that there are no problems despite all these evidence. And finally, DHS is the institute in question. And because we don't have them involved, we've had anonymous, but people come forward from DHS. They would not have come forward if they knew that they might be tracked and they lose their job or be retaliated against.
Okay. We've got about 10 seconds left. What happens next?
We send this report to our state legislators, our city officials, with the recommendations, and we urge that they take them seriously and make changes.
All right. David O., Philadelphia City Council Member at Large, thank you so much for joining us. Lots more to this story. I'm sure we'll be covering some more of it on the Regional Roundup. Stay tuned for more.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Pennsylvania's primary election is coming up fast, just over 2 weeks away. And in fact, today is the deadline to register to vote. This will be a primary of significant consequence as Republicans and Democrats choose nominees for governor, lieutenant governor, U.S. Senate, and the state's 17 seats in the House of Representatives. However, nearly 1.5 million Pennsylvanians will be largely left out of the process. Pennsylvania's primary is a closed election, meaning those who are unaffiliated with the major political parties are ineligible to vote for candidates in the May 17th election. Proponents for change say allowing independent voters to take part in primary elections will help ease political polarization and more fully realize the democratic process. And indeed, there is legislation before state lawmakers which would open Pennsylvania's primary system. We're going to take a deeper look at the process now, joined by David Thornburg, chair of Ballot PA, a project of the Committee of 70. Good to have you back with us, David.
Thank you, Mary. My pleasure.
First of all, you say this is arguably the most important primary in Pennsylvania history. How so?
Well, by my reckoning, this is the first time in our 235-year history that voters, at least those who can participate, have had a chance to vote on an open governor's seat, an open Senate seat, new congressional maps, and new state legislative maps at the same time. So it's never happened before, and it makes it all that more frustrating and ironic that we're shutting out, as you said, almost 1.5 million voters in Pennsylvania. So we believe it's time to change that.
David, let's talk about who these voters are. Do they tend to lean Democrat or Republican, or are they usually completely unaffiliated?
Well, there's Pew research that's been done at the national level that suggests that they do lean. Most of them, maybe 80% of them, but they're less partisan voters. And I think that's important. And you say, well, how do you know that? Well, if they were more partisan voters, they would be registered R's and D's.
Sure.
And I think we live in a time of great political polarization. So among other things, I mean, there's a basic question of fairness as well, but it feels like letting those folks into primary elections would broaden the base and help quiet our politics and ultimately send people to Harrisburg, Washington, and everywhere in between who are ready to govern.
Independents are the fastest growing part of Pennsylvania's electorate. Is that the case?
Yeah, and that's been true. They're growing 30 times faster than the Democratic Party and 30% faster than the Republican Party. There's a couple other interesting things that we've done, and I'm not aware of anyone else who's looked at these issues. About half of all veterans identify as political independents, which again seems nonsensical, if not tragic, that we ask men and women to put their lives on the line to defend our country, and then when they come home to Pennsylvania, tell them that they can't vote.
Hmm.
We've also learned that some fast-growing segments of the Pennsylvania population, namely Hispanic voters, Asian voters, Indian voters, are much more likely to be registered as independents. So that, again, feels like we're working at cross purposes. And finally, young voters, 18 to 34-year-old voters in Pennsylvania, are almost twice as likely to register as independents. And for all the hand-wringing that we've done about how we get young people involved in politics and democracy and voting, again, it seems like that's just not fair and we're working at cross purposes. So there are a lot of reasons why I think this change is one whose time has come.
Well, so Pennsylvania's primaries have been closed for many decades. Why do proponents of the closed system believe a voting prohibition for independents is necessary?
Well, it's hard to sort of pin down. It's a little like trying to pin Jell-O to the wall. I think it begins with a natural note of caution among folks who have been elected in the current system, who are not anxious to change that. But a lot of our emphasis in this Ballot PA effort is education and awareness. Both parties understand that there's no particular partisan edge to how independents are likely to vote. One of our survey results suggested that about 40% this time would have chosen to vote in the Republican primary, another 32% in the Democratic primary, and the rest would choose to make up their mind. So you don't see a partisan pattern in all that. And then I think when we remind folks that, you know, foundational to this country is the sense that every eligible voter ought to be able to vote in every election. So there is a basic issue of fairness. Some folks say this sounds like as acute an example of taxation without representation as you could possibly imagine. So again, I think there are powerful arguments that it's time to make this change.
So what would the impact on major party candidates be then? Would it be negligible?
Well, there's unknowns. We can make some projections about how independent voters would turn out and vote. We do know from other states that registration and turnout would likely go up, which, forget about who wins and who loses, is just a good thing. You know, again, we wring our hands about how we get turnout up for particularly municipal elections and state elections. So that's likely to occur. The question is for the parties. I think this could very well help both political parties if they see this as an opportunity to let voters sort of try before you buy, that an independent voter can vote in their party's primary without, you know, signing on the line to join that party. It gives them a sort of a soft on-ramp on to the values and principles and candidates that the parties stand for. So I think, you know, with that approach, and I'll note we have the support of two former chairs of Pennsylvania political parties.
Really?
Alan Novak, former Republican chair, and T.J. Rooney, former Democratic chair. So I think their affirmation is a strong statement that says this can be really good for parties as well.
Yeah, and this could open up the process in some rural areas especially because, as I understand it, David, primary elections often decide races in those locations where the population's
small. Well, not just rural areas. I mean, here we are in Philadelphia where, because of the party registration, the Democratic primary is the only race.
Oh, sure.
And that's true elsewhere, and that's true for a lot of reasons, but statewide we see races, 80-90% of all races are decided in the primary. Once again, there, which just rubs dirt in the wound of independent voters, because if you don't vote in the primary, your vote basically doesn't count. The game's over before you even got there.
I'd like to bring State Representative Chris Quinn into the conversation. He is a Republican who represents the 168th Legislative District in the State House of Representatives, serving parts of Delaware County. And Chris has introduced legislation to open up the primaries to independent and nonpartisan voters. Chris Quinn, welcome to the Regional Roundup.
Good morning, Mary. Thank you.
Good morning.
Thank you for having me. David, good to hear you.
Likewise, Chris.
So Chris Quinn, why do you think the primary system needs to change?
Well, I think it comes down to extremists on both sides of the aisle. How do we begin to get back to a more centrist government? And we literally, when I look at what's currently going on in Harrisburg, I see a breakdown of the whole system. The extremists are going to both sides, and as you just mentioned, 80 to 90% of these elections are literally decided in the primaries. When I first came to Harrisburg, I had a gentleman by the name of Dom Costa. He was a Democrat from Pittsburgh, a solid guy. We worked on a number of pieces of legislation together. He was taken out by a Democratic Socialist because he wasn't far enough to the left. And in this cycle, the way David was just beginning to highlight, on my side of the aisle, I see a number of reasonable people, even guys that I would consider very conservative, potentially being taken out by people that are even further extremists. So it's a real problem that we have in Pennsylvania.
Well, and it obviously works both ways, doesn't it, David Thornburg?
Well, sure. I mean, what we know from research and practice is that the small number of people who turn out in primary elections tend to be from the extremes of both parties. And then, not surprisingly, they support and then elect more extreme candidates. So we end up with the dysfunction that Representative Quinn just described. You've got a bunch of folks elected to Harrisburg or Washington or anywhere in between who don't have a political incentive to play to the center or to play to a broad base of voters. They simply rely on the support of their narrow and more extreme political base. And And that's very damaging to the system.
Chris Quinn, tell us about your legislation. What would it do?
Hello?
Chris Quinn? Chris, you there?
Yes. Sorry, I thought I lost you for a second.
Well, thankfully you are with us. And so the question is, tell us about the bill you've introduced and how it would work.
Well, the bill itself is it's targeting independent voters, truly unaffiliated voters, people that are not part of any, even a little subsection. They're people that are just tired of the extreme partisan politics, and we're trying to figure out how to bring them back in. So they're upwards of 40% of the population at this point. And I think it's very reasonable to ask them to continue to participate in the process. Anyway, long story short, just to cut to the chase, How do we get more people involved in the process? And it's to try to get those disillusioned voters back in.
So this your legislation would say to independents and unaffiliated voters, okay, you can participate in the primary process when voting for candidates such as those for governors, you know, nominees, political party nominees. Similar bipartisan legislation, Chris, passed the state Senate several years ago, installed in the House. What sort of support is there for your bill among your fellow representatives now? What are you hearing?
Well, you know, it's funny. As you move any piece of legislation through the process, I was able to get the first pipeline safety bill through in 50 years. I was able to get an epilepsy bill that had some different people trying to stop it than you would think. I think this legislation, it's time for it. And when you talk about, do I think it's going to pass this session? I do not. But I think next session, if we come back with someone like David Thornburg assisting me with this process, being able to get more legislators on board, and literally, I think this is going to be a grassroots effort. This is going to be individuals contacting their representatives, asking them to co-sponsor and pushing it. It's not going to pass this session.
No, not in time for the May 17th primary. But so you're hopeful. You're hopeful. Is that you laughing there,
I'm
David?
Very hopeful.
Yeah, you'd have a lot of apoplectic election administrators if you suggested we were going to try to get this done between now and then.
Sure. Well, listen, hang on one second. I just wanted to say thank you to State Representative Chris Quinn for joining us. Chris represents the 168th Legislative District in the State House, and that serves parts of Delaware County. It was a pleasure, Chris.
Thank you very much, Mary. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
You too. Okay. Did you have a point there you wanted to make, David?
Well, I'm just going to say I think we're going to all be paying close attention to what happens in the May 17th primary. This is an extraordinary election season for both parties. I'll say both parties have candidates who are kind of populists on the extreme who are actively running against their own parties in the primary, which is extraordinary. So there could be a much greater focus on this issue, you know, on May 18th than there has been the last couple months, because as Representative Quinn, I think, pointed out, we may really need to figure out ways to broaden the base of elections to push back against this the extremes that have taken over our political process.
I'd like to get to some listener response. David emails us and says, with radical and fringe elements rising, are the new independents just moderate Republicans who no longer wish to be affiliated with the party, but not willing to register as Democrats? Do you have any information about the motive behind some independent voters?
No, I don't, although I think I have been an independent, and I've known a lot of independents, and I really believe they are that's too simple a characterization. I think they are folks that like to have choice, like to think about candidates and not what color jersey the candidates are wearing. You know, again, the research has suggested that they're not going to break primarily for one party or the other. But it is, by the way, a swing electorate. I think you know, one story of the presidential race between 2020 and 2015 is that swing vote, that independent voters went from Trump to Biden in Pennsylvania. And that's true in a lot of states. So that's a good thing. I think, you know, for elections to be competitive, there have to be voters whose votes you can't predict. And I think that's one aspect that independent voters could bring to this process.
Well, it sure makes it interesting, doesn't it?
Well, it should be interesting. Every election ought to be hard fought. And at the end of the day, as I said, you get 50% plus one, you win. And then we move on from there. And but unfortunately, we've been leaving folks out of the process. And that feels un-American.
Couple more comments. Email from Thomas. The idea is not only open, but proportional, right?
No, this is not a proportional idea. This simply says if you're an independent voter, you get to pick which primary you participate in. So you get to vote in the Republican Party or the Democratic primary without having to join that party. I'll point out this is the same system that states like New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and as of a few years ago, Colorado have adopted. And I think they've demonstrated that when you run this statewide, you end up with people who are able to govern from the center, which is sort of the whole point of it. So this is not a new idea. Pennsylvania is one of the last 9 states that hasn't figured out a way to include independents. So we got a lot of other examples to learn from.
We've got about 30 seconds left. We have this listener tweet. If independents can vote for any candidate in either party, I will switch to being an independent. And again, we're talking about the primary election here. Do you see this opening up, if such legislation were to pass, opening up the closed primary, seeing an increase in the number of independents participating in the political process?
That's wholly a factor of how the parties react. I think if the parties see this as an opportunity, again, this is a try before you buy for independent voters, very well could mean that the party ranks would swell. But I think that is in their hands. But again, our judgment on this issue should not be, at the end of the day, how it affects the parties. It should be an issue of fairness and representation.
Very quickly, David Thornburg, are you hopeful this legislation will pass? Just very quickly, about 5 seconds, soon.
I wouldn't be in this unless I were hopeful. Okay. I think there's a path forward, and I think this is an idea whose time has come.
David Thornburg, Chair of Ballot PA, thanks so much for joining us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is the Regional Roundup. Welcome back. Centuries ago, when Europeans first came to this country, an estimated 500,000 acres of spectacular Atlantic white cedar forest could be found from Maine to northern Florida and along the Gulf Coast. Over 100,000 acres stood in New Jersey alone. The Atlantic white cedar can live for hundreds and even 1,000 years. A forest of white cedar is known for its sense of quiet. Visitors have called the experience sublime. But like so much of nature, the Atlantic white cedar has been decimated by human activity, and these days in particular, climate change. A mere 25,000 acres remain in New Jersey, tucked away in the boggy areas of the Pine Barrens. And ironically, as climate change threatens the Atlantic white cedar, it can act as a powerful tool to counteract the effects of climate change. So the state of New Jersey is now working to restore thousands of acres of this native tree. Joining us for the rest of the hour to tell us more are Sean Lortorette, Commissioner of the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. Good to have you with us once again, Sean.
It is a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for the invitation, and I'm excited to talk about this really, really important topic.
Well, thank you. And Matthew Olson is an assistant professor of environmental science at Stockton University. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. I'm really looking forward to this discussion.
As are we. So let's start. I've never seen an Atlantic white cedar forest. Describe what it's like to experience one. Sean, let's start with you first.
Sure, I would say it feels majestic and stately even. We have large stands of Atlantic white cedar where they still remain. They are incredibly tall. They reach up to the sky. Their root structure and the sort of forest bed that surrounds them is diverse and vibrant with really exciting ecology, home to some of our more endangered plants or threatened plants and wildlife. It is both peaceful and exciting in its quiet way.
Yeah. It's also called a white cedar swamp, I understand, because these trees just love boggy, mucky wetland soil. But Matt Olson, this can also be their undoing with climate change and sea level rise, particularly in New Jersey. Tell us more about this.
Yeah. So some of the issues that we faced with Atlantic white cedar is the fact that it is an obligate wetland species. So it basically means that it primarily grows in wetlands. It's also a very coastally restricted species. So it's really, most of its range, it's within 50 to 100 miles of the coast itself. So a lot of the sites where it's growing are kind of low-lying, and those areas are vulnerable to sea level rise impacts, in particular salinization, where saltwater kind of makes its way into those wetlands. And that Atlantic white cedar is not very salt tolerant, so something like that can actually stress the trees and even lead to excessive mortality.
And another stressor, Matt, Ben Franklin first raised an alarm about the white cedar centuries ago, and of course climate change maybe perhaps was in its infancy back then, so that wasn't the threat. What was it?
Yeah, at that time, it was mainly unregulated timber harvesting for wood products. Some have described Atlantic white cedar as being New Jersey's, or at least southern New Jersey's, most important timber species, in large part because it has really desirable wood characteristics. And for that reason, it's been used in numerous wood products. But over the centuries, it's basically been cut without any type of what I would think of as being forest management really being implemented, just basically being exploitatively cut.
I've read that Independence Hall in Philly has an Atlantic white cedar shingle roof. Is that true?
To be quite honest, I'm not entirely sure, but it would not surprise me one bit.
So, Sean LaTourette, Atlantic white cedar forests, again, can help to mitigate climate change. How so? Do we have Sean with us?
Yes. Sorry about that. I was on mute.
Oh, okay. Glad to have you back.
So one of the reasons that an Atlantic white cedar forest is so vital in our attempt to build a greater and more diverse carbon pool throughout the state is, first, of course, its ability as a large tree to lock up carbon over the long term. But just as importantly, given the peat soils and that wetland boggy characteristic that's been described, creating more of that habitat allows us to better lock up carbon, not just in the tree itself, but along the forest floor, within those wetlands, within those soils. And that has a really great effect of adding to our ability to sequester carbon.
Sean, tell us about the stands of trees called ghost forests in the Pine Barrens. Describe these and how they came to be.
Sure. So there's a couple of different stands that you might call a ghost forest. One that's particularly notable is more coastal in nature, where as a function of saltwater intrusion, as Matt was explaining, storm surge from Superstorm Sandy, you see these salt intolerant trees effectively die off. And as they die off, right, they lose their cedar quality. They look ashy and gray, and as you stand among them, you feel as though you're almost in a graveyard, and that is a ghost forest, right? And we have other examples of that throughout the Pinelands, not because of sea level rise, but because of significant flooding. Because while these are obligate wetland areas, they can't have too much water, right? There is a balance to be struck. And so we see areas where ghost forests are created because they've been effectively flooded out.
Let's talk about some other potential threats to the Atlantic white cedar. I live not too far from the Pine Barrens, and the signs are already up about, fire threats. Matt Olson, is fire a significant concern where the Atlantic white cedar is concerned?
Yeah, certainly. It's a major concern, but it's also for kind of contradictory reasons. So certainly the stands themselves can be vulnerable to heavy mortality from a fire if you have the right set of conditions, really, say, prolonged drought or something like that kind of dries out the wetland. That could allow fire from the surrounding uplands to spread into the wetland and effectively kill off the stand that way. So in a sense, it can actually lead to a reduction in the acreage of Atlantic white cedar dominated wetland. But Atlantic white cedar, interestingly, can also regenerate after those types of disturbances, assuming that you don't lose too much of the capacity for the cedar to grow back. So it's kind of can be a bad in some cases, but it can also be positive in other ways in that it can create opportunities for Atlantic white cedar to regenerate in the aftermath of those disturbances.
And how about animals? I've heard, for instance, that the beaver population is not necessarily good for their ecosystem, the cedar's ecosystem.
Yeah. So I think for the same reason Sean was bringing up is one of the big challenges we face has to do with fluctuating water table. So like changing hydrology whether the water table increases and floods out areas, which is more the case of the beaver impeding drainage and basically flooding out areas. That's basically going to kill the trees. It's going to suffocate the trees or drown them out, so to say. But another condition, too, is like that could also lead to other areas of wetland drying out. And if you do that, then you kind of strand the root systems well below the water table, which again kind of kills the trees because they no longer have adequate water.
So there's a lot to manage in trying to restore the white cedar population in New Jersey. Sean LaTourette, the state of New Jersey is investing $19 million in this effort to restore thousands of acres of Atlantic white cedar forest. What is the goal here? How many acres would you like to see restored?
I mean, we'd like to see as many acres as we can get. We're anticipating that this effort will restore approximately 10,000 acres. If there is an opportunity to expand upon that, we are certainly inclined to go after that. But the thought here is that over a 10-year period, we can restore approximately 10,000 acres. The goal of connecting the existing stands of cedar, those that haven't been exploited or those that have not been succumbing to the types of issues we've been discussing. And then we restore in the process the habitats that are diminishing for certain species while improving water quality. And this is a really important point, particularly in parts of the state where folks are incredibly reliant upon surface water and groundwater recharge of the aquifers that supply drinking water.
So what does the restoration process itself involve? Do you bring backhoes in to take out, competing vegetation? What happens?
So you might have a hearing something like this. You might have a vision in your mind of hordes of foresters descending upon the pinelands with saplings to plant. But really, the first step for us is going to be removing that competing vegetation. For example, the oaks that have come into areas where white cedar are and in a way kind of shading them out and pushing them out off that part of the landscape. So the first step is going to be bringing in the type of equipment that will be able to get some of those competing species out and provide the opportunity for the cedar to take back the area through a natural process. So that'll be our initial step. Not suggesting we aren't going to do any plantings, but nature needs to be allowed to do its work. And we believe that it will in this phase of the project.
Matt Olson, not sure if you have this information at your fingertips, but can some of the ghost forests be brought back, or is there still a saltwater threat there?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Off the top of my head, I'll just to give you a sense of that. You know, one of the issues with the saltwater intrusion issue is that it's fundamentally changing soil chemistry, and it would probably be pretty costly to undo some of those impacts. So what we're seeing is really a very targeted restoration strategy where a lot of the headwater areas of the major Pine Barren streams, those are the areas that are really the targets for restoration work, not so much along the coast where in some ways it'd be kind of a losing proposition, may not be a good investment for those limited restoration dollars.
Sure. And white cedar wood is still being harvested, right, Matt?
It is, but it's not, you know, obviously not what it was historically, but there is still a harvest that is taking place. We don't really have the capacity here in state as far as mills and things like that to handle, you know, that kind of stuff. So what does happen is very local and very dispersed, but really not too much of an impact.
One of the fun things about this show is you learn something new all the time. You're speaking with Paige Murray Bessler and mentioned that timber sales can actually be important for something called silviculture. What's that?
Yeah. So silviculture is both art and science. So it basically takes basically our understanding of forests, puts that into practice so that we can grow trees for the variety of goods and services that they provide to society. And it's really about meeting landowner objectives. So basically the idea being that through application of silviculture and kind of more science-based responsible uses of silviculture, we can actually leave the forest in a better condition than we entered it in.
And it does have to be a collaborative effort these days.
Agreed, yeah. It's definitely something where we have to work across lines and we need to get all stakeholders kind of on the same page to find kind of what's the best suite of options moving forward to benefit the species and the ecosystem.
Sean LaTourette, so the $19 million comes from a settlement with companies which manufactured gasoline containing a water contaminant called MTBE. So something good has come from a real environmental negative here?
Yeah, that's right. So one of the things that we do at the DEP is to ensure that when the public suffers an injury to its natural resources, because our air, our land, our water, our forests, they aren't owned by the government. They are owned by the people. And it is just the government's job to take good care of them because of those valuable services, as Matt explained, that are being provided by our natural resources. So when there is harm, like the deep contamination of our groundwater supplies by these constituents of gasoline, we pursue those responsible. And what we ask them to do is to improve the resource that they've harmed. And so here, the reestablishment of Atlantic White Cedar Forest allows us to improve that groundwater resource and give back to the public something that was taken away.
The state is building on some groundbreaking legislation enacted over 40 years ago, the Pinelands Protection Act, which preserved 1 million acres of pinelands. Matt Olson, does it bear imagining where we would be today if this hadn't happened? What do you think?
Wow, that's another great question. Yeah, that's something I haven't really pondered. But yeah, I mean, that was just such a momentous decision that was made. I mean, if it wasn't for that, I don't think I would have the love for the forest, and I wouldn't be in my current position right now.
The question is, how would the Pinelands look, do you think?
That's a really hard one. If there was more, say, timber interest or something like that, we might see a very different landscape than what we see at present. Not to say that that's necessarily a bad thing, but it would likely be very different than what we currently see.
Well, here's a less intense question for you. As any person who's hung around the Pine Barrens knows, if you try to take a dip in the water, you better bring an old bathing suit. Is the white cedar responsible for what we call, cedar water, which is the color of tea?
It is. It's going to be one of the big contributors to that. But we just have a lot of vegetation that when their parts break down and decompose, they release a lot of organic acids that basically make their way through our very porous soils and then get into our waterways. And all that kind of contributes to the cedar water appearance that we have.
So that was a lighter side question. But Sean LaTourette, as we wrap up about 15 seconds here, anything you'd like to add to the conversation before we close?
I think what's important to note is how nature is always sending us important messages. And if we really pay attention, the Atlantic white cedar are sending us a message that New Jersey is going to look and feel different than it does today as a function of human-caused climate change. And we're sitting here talking about the migration, effectively, of Atlantic white cedar that can no longer take good root in its coastal community.
Well, we're excited about the prospect, yep, for the restoration process. Unfortunately, we've got to leave it there. Sean LaTourette, great to have you with us, Commissioner of New Jersey's Department of Environmental Protection. Thanks.
Thank you.
And Matt Olson, a pleasure, Assistant Professor of Environmental Science at Stockton University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Diana Martinez is our engineer, Paige Mary Bessler, our producer. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan.